polygraph.
But who have not had adverse career action.
That's correct. Your final determination of what you're saying is adverse career action. I mean, a letter in my file that says that I'm unsuitable as an employee because of the outcome of this procedure, or a week of forced leave without pay, these I consider adverse actions. In these reports, it actually says the number of people who had adverse actions, and I just took right out of the report, that's where I got that column. So these things that you're saying now, these are revealing something that's not contained in that report.
It's not contained in how you are deciphering the nomenclature at the top of that report.
So when you result favorably might indicate someone who admitted to taking classified material home and was reprimanded for that and was told don't ever do it again and you might get fired if you do it again.
Typically got it at home when they returned home, they opened up the newspaper in the briefcase and there it was. Scared to death, run outside, burn it in the barbecue pit. That happens constantly.
It wasn't constantly.
Some people even rush home and bring it back to work at 12 o'clock at night because they discovered it at home. We discovered that during the testing. Is that a termination offense? I think not. Those happen all the time, where the unreported foreign contacts, it gains the government information, which is then investigated by name checks of the foreign personality, checks of indices of foreign intelligence service members. They may or may not be there, but we at least now know who the individuals are that are members of foreign governments that our employees meeting with. And we simply put those in the dossier in case there are future events that occur that we might need to know that information. So there is an initial significant response noted. There are admissions, confessions, clarifications. Those are documented. We then move on to complete the test for the benefit of the employee and the government and simply collect that information, put it in a dossier. Those dossiers are available only to security officials. They are not available to management, to the boss.
What happens in the case where they fail the initial test and there's no admission and it was decided they just had an off day, they were sick that day or something? Is that also going to resolve favorably, or does that never happen?
They are brought back at other times. I mean, we had a...
Where do they go in this table? Is that a resolve favorably? Or is that a truthful?
It would be a... Well, that depends the result of the initial test. If it was simply inconclusive, then it would end up being a truthful. If it was a significant response noted and was later cleared up, it could be a favorably resolved.
So that's a combination. So resolved favorably is a combination of minor offenses plus people who kind of recovered and passed it on the second time without any minor offenses.
Correct. As an example, a lady came into our office just a short time ago, 7:30 in the morning. She had dropped her husband off, unbeknownst to us, for his first cancer chemotherapy at 5 o'clock in the morning in Washington. She didn't want any special treatment. She wanted to take the test, didn't tell us. She was absolutely fit to be tied, understandably. The test results were inconclusive. We don't know if it's inconclusive because she's hiding something or other confounding effects. We simply told her, you come back in 2 months when your husband's finished his course. She did that, successfully completed the test with absolutely no problem. That's a truthful.
But in any case,
she did not make admissions per se.
No more than like 2.3% fail in this
example.
Correct. Would that lady have been in the truthful column or the resolved favorably column?
That lady is in the truthful column, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Dr. Iacono's point, as I understand it, is valid. You're saying that this is a useful way of collecting a lot of information about the number of activity that goes on around people who possess classified information. But in fact, Dr. Iacono is saying you're not catching a whole lot of spies. It's not their employees who are spies. I don't have any sense of that.
That's an essential idea.
Can I suggest? Oh,
just one. From your answer to Emmett's questions then, and to Kathy's questions, it seems that you're implying want to make this explicit. You're implying that the resolved favorably numbers are actually significant or inconclusive responses that were corroborated by other evidence, confession, et cetera, that there was a problem, but then they were judged minor, they were judged not to require firing, et cetera.
Not exactly. Persons could have exhibited specific response to a test,
right,
but upon later testing, for a reason unknown to us, cleared that up.
Okay, and now, so another column would be those numbers subtracted from the resolve favorably based on admissions and corroborating evidence. And what would those numbers look like?
Say that again,
Doc.
Okay.
If you took those numbers out of resolved favorably.
What's left?
So in other words, you could split the resolved favorably into two categories. Yeah. One is admissions, another is retook the test and they came out okay.
Right.
How would that split look?
Yeah.
Jim, I think I actually called some minute of table to me not too long ago to try and ferret the data out and best attempt from all agencies. That data is not collected, it's not separated.
Well,
I mean, it makes an enormous difference in the value of polygraphing, particularly with regard to the possibility of false negatives, because what you're implying is that part of the value of the polygraph is preventive. And people are going to be watched and presumably not, you know, their hand will slap once, they're going to be very careful, et cetera. So that there is some utility to that part of the test, whether or not it's based on science or not. The only possibility in these data, it seems to me, that we've identified spies, is in the last column.
And just to be clear, since that's my next slide, what's in the last column, according to these reports, is denying or withholding access to classified information. These were not things that were characterized as adverse action. Apparently discipline, though, is something that happens to people in the favorably resolved columns, but these things aren't covered in these reports.
I don't consider a letter of warning or admonishment discipline, you may. We don't, and we don't hold it against the employee. Actually, it's not known to management most of the time. If it's known to management, the individual decides to tell his manager, I was there, I had a problem, just want you to know.
The eight people who had adverse action, no, these weren't the adverse actions that were taken. This is how it's described in the report. My point is that you're giving 32,000 tests. There's a risk to the morale of employees, the likelihood people want to even keep a job like this and stay with a career like this. And this is a solution to a problem. The problem is people like Robert Hansen and Alder James, and if it's the solution, where's the evidence? Those spies identified, I hear this over and over again, without question, all the time from people in government. It doesn't matter whether the tests work or not, they have utility. And the evidence for utility comes in those 600 people or whatever who sort of quote-unquote failed the polygraph test, and said things like they took a disk home and put it on their home computer. I don't think this is what we have in mind when we institute a large-scale screening policy like this to catch spies. I don't think finding out that someone inadvertently took a computer disk home is a significant discovery that warrants this type of government oversight of people's lives using a procedure that has questionable validity. And it's also claimed that these procedures have deterrent value. I don't know where the evidence is for that either. And I hope this committee, to the extent that you're able to find, look at accuracy. You can also look at utility. And at some point, I guess you'll probably do something like a cost-benefit analysis. I think that's an important step. This is just another point that kind of reiterates something that was said before, but almost no one fails in personnel screening. That's what the last couple slides show. But in pre-employment screening, a lot of people fail. And what this tells you is that examiners adjust the threshold for failure based on the likely problems caused by failing somebody. They don't fail lots of people who are already employed, because they know that very few of these people are likely to be spies, and the cost of failing large numbers of them would be horrendous. But the four people employed by the government, and there's no investment in them, it's much easier to fail people on these tests. Yes?
You said that there's no evidence regarding the deterrence value of testing. What could such evidence be?
Well, an example would be, I don't know what it would be, but an example would be you have two agencies that are comparable. One has a polygraph screening program and the other doesn't. And you do checks, follow-up studies for 10 years to find out which agency has more problems. You would then find that the one that has the polygraph, there's fewer spies that come out of that group, for instance. And you'd assume then that the spies all went to work for the other agencies because they knew they didn't have to take a polygraph test and they could get away with it.
We have 30 years of research on that in the criminal domain and very clear evidence that that kind of study is worthless when you want to compare with real direct measurements.
I don't think you could do the study and get anything out of it, but if it's going to be claimed that it has deterrent value, then I'd like to see some basis for it.
I don't disagree with that statement, mm-hmm. but it strikes me that it's non-trivial to answer Richard's
question. I agree.
And I don't know how to design
it. It would cost a lot of money, and I'm not sure anyone would care.
And if anybody had some thoughts on it, I think we would be very, very interested. This is an issue that we have discussed, and we have sort of interacted on, and on which it's very, very hard to get information that would allow you to quantify any effect in any setting.
Okay. I agree. Sometimes it's brought up the idea that retesting is a way to protect people against false positives. And we can ask the question, which is, what's the evidence about retest reliability for polygraph testing? Like, what do we know about people being tested on independent occasions by different examiners on the same issue? And the answer is, we don't know anything, because retest reliability studies in polygraph haven't been done. There are lots of reasons to worry about retesting as a method to protect innocent people. In the first place, as soon as someone fails a test, they're at that point already identified as someone who's failed a test and they're stigmatized. The bottom part of this slide just points to things that there's a lot of sharing of information among polygraphers that is done in such a way that makes it difficult for the second testing of an individual who's failed a test to literally be independent of the first test. So it's going to be colored to some extent by the fact that the people who are testing the person the second time are going to know something about the outcome of the first test. And this makes having a person retested as a way of protecting them from a false positive outcome.
Are there any studies of where there are multiple testings in which the second examiner is blind to the outcome of the first exam, and in which the outcome of the first exam doesn't influence whether or not you get a second one?
And I'm saying there is no such study that I'm aware of. And there are other reasons why retesting is impractical. First place, I hate to be a person who's failed two polygraphs in a situation like this and then, you know, had to deal with that, because it implies just like you're twice as likely to be a serious deficient in some way. Also, I think there are individual difference factors that are likely to affect why a person fails a polygraph test. It's not just anybody who's going to fail a polygraph test. There probably are some reasons why certain people are more likely to produce a false positive on one test. And I think those reasons are going to carry over into the administration of the second test. There's no reason to assume that a false positive outcome is just going to be randomly distributed across people. And it's also unreasonable to assume that someone who took a test and failed is going to enter into the second test full of assurance that they're going to come out with flying colors. So if we're going to adopt retesting as a procedure to protect people, I think a lot of work needs to be done before we'd be comfortable with how we do that and how we'd understand what the results would mean. Brought up in your question was, what can we do to protect people who fail a polygraph test? I mentioned here, no adverse action unless wrongdoing is confirmed. Polygraph testing, employee management kept separate. These are things that kind of sound like they're in place, at least for some government agencies. I think people's rights would also be protected if they were given a copy of the polygraph session. I could review that with an attorney, for instance, if they felt that problem with the testing. I think there are real concerns, though, about a polygraph testing program like this, like what happens to DOE, career officials, CIA officials, FBI officials. If they have problems on polygraph tests, what happens to them in the future? Do they get the best assignments? Do they get promoted along with everyone else? Do they have the same type of career advancement? This is actually a study you could do. You could go back historically, say 10 years ago, and find the 600 people in the late 1980s who had unfavorable outcomes on polygraph tests, and find a comparable group of another 600 who were tested at the same time, and find out how their careers have advanced over the last decade, to see if they've suffered any adverse consequences, and simply haven't fallen into that category of unfavorable outcome.
Can we back up for a second? Would you support similar protections if I complained and said, I believe that the GRE treated me badly? That when I took my GRE as a bomb school, they didn't buy it in school. That's how I ended up not getting a clinical psychology. So what for But suppose I were to say, I believe that the GRE affected me badly. Should I have a right to have a videotape which includes the questions?
Did you know they sent you the questions now for the SAT?
The full set?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Your daughter just took them. They give you the questions and they tell you what the answers were and what you were writing what you were wrong.
Wow. Well, I guess the answer is yes. I'm astonished.
I don't know if you get a chance to do this. I assume in some of your public hearings you have, but a lot of people who take polygraph tests have been very upset by the actual administration of the test. And they've made claims about the way the test has gone that they feel has influenced the outcome, and they're not getting a job, for instance. And so one protection against that is to make this type of information available. I've talked with some of these people, and they actually do record these sessions, but they don't provide them to the people who have taken the polygraph test. And people request them under the Freedom of Information Act, and by the time they actually get them to the point where someone agrees, okay, you can have the tape, they're told the tape doesn't exist. And so this is not a way to protect people's rights. A few things about countermeasures. In the first place, this is the pattern of autonomic reactivity that you're trying to produce. This comes from various polygraph texts and right now it's from Doug Williams' book, Sting the Polygraph. But you're trying to show a suppression of your respiration, so you breathe a little bit more shallow, have a nice GSR response, and an increase in blood pressure. These autonomic responses are pretty easy to manipulate, and anybody who works with making recordings from humans and measuring events that register in the autonomic nervous system knows this sort of thing. And that's what countermeasures research is all about. And I think it's interesting to just look at this for a second to realize this is not rocket science. We're talking about people mastering here. This is not a very difficult thing to be able to do. There's lots of sources of information about how to do this, including Dr. Hunt's articles, for instance, Licken's book, and these various websites that we've talked about. I just want to say a few things about motivation, and I don't single out Dr. Hunt's here to criticize him, but just to illustrate how different the world is for laboratory subjects being in a countermeasure experiment versus what it might be like for a spy who's working for a foreign government and trying to infiltrate our government. In one of the early studies that he did, he told people they'd lose their promised reward for being in the study if they were caught using countermeasures. And so the reward, I believe, was course credit, and the students really wanted the course credit. So at the risk of losing their course credit, they didn't adopt the countermeasures at all, even though they were instructed in that group to do it. There was a disincentive. They were worried that if they did it and they got caught, they'd lose their course credit. So they didn't employ the countermeasures. Motivation is a key factor in these kinds of studies. And some of this other type of research, people are given 15 minutes to learn about a polygraph test and countermeasures, and then they're tested to see if they can beat the test. In real life, we're not going to have people doing 15 minutes of research to figure out how to get through a polygraph test. Training, Dr. Hunt's mentioned, involved no more than a half hour. A lot of it was about how to recognize the proper kinds of questions and to execute the countermeasures without being observable. But imagine what countermeasure training could be if you actually hooked people up to a polygraph and rehearsed questions with them and actually showed them those charts to see how well they were reproducing those kinds of autonomic nervous system response patterns that you're supposed to produce when you're aroused by a question that you're lying to. Another thing I think is really important in this line of research is the importance of choice. Spies are not randomly assigned to being a spy. There have to be enormous factors that go into people becoming a spy. I don't know what they all are. But if we want to evaluate how well countermeasures work in a context like this, then we might give people the freedom to choose whether or not they're going to be guilty or innocent, the freedom to choose what kind of a countermeasure they're most comfortable using, and the choice of whether to use countermeasures at all in a study. And I think all these things, motivation, choice, very important. I think Dr. Hans and I agree that there's no reason to think that countermeasures would not be effective in this context. His research shows clearly that examiners can't detect people using countermeasures. The full realm of countermeasures haven't even been explored in this line of research. Countermeasures are not really used to any significant extent and don't seem likely to be used in a way that's going to make much difference. And then I just conclude this section with this. Does anybody here believe if you pay a spy $1 million that he couldn't learn how to beat a polygraph test as opposed to be given 3 points of course credit in intro set? Or that a foreign government doesn't have the resources to help someone do this, or that a foreign government couldn't train its agents in this country, send them to an American Polygraph Association accredited polygraph school, or hire agents from Canada or Israel who are trained in similar techniques, or even buy a polygraph school in this country and run it to make sure that their agents get the opportunity to learn about polygraph and these types of techniques.
Is there any evidence on the magnitude of rewards or sanctions? Studies that have systematically varied the magnitude of rewards and sanctions and looked at how that influences?
I'm not sure. I can't think of such a study. There is widespread belief that motivation is important, and the types of meta-analyses that have been done have looked at motivation as a factor in increasing hit rates. But the type of study you talked about, I'm not quite sure has been done. Individual difference variables, there's not much to say about them except I think when Dr. Hans was talking about them, he was referring in particular about their effect on procedures that have been examined in the literature, which doesn't, for the most part, include employee screening types tests, like personnel screening and pre-employment screening tests. I want to point out, though, one area of psychopathology that has been investigated, maybe you've run across these studies, and I'm going to say something about them in a minute anyway, and that has to do with the idea of a psychopath beating a polygraph test. And the research that's been done using a control question test actually shows that a psychopath can't beat a polygraph test. However, that's different than, I think, what happens in a screening test, because part of what happens in a screening test is that it's a give-and-take interview between the polygrapher and the person taking the test. And the polygrapher needs to be convinced by the time the test is finished that the person taking the test is truthful. And that's what psychopaths are good at. They're good at convincing people that they're telling the truth, even when we have reason to doubt them. So in that type of employment screening, where there's a lot of give and take, and a polygraph has a large component of it based on interview, I think it's an open question whether or not psychopaths could pass these tests. A few things about research designs. Dr. Hans has already mentioned that we have a laboratory, which are mock crime type studies and field studies. A lot of emphasis has been used in mock crime studies to make the crimes more realistic. But what's really missing in mock crime studies is the consequences of being caught. And I just want to show you one comparison of two studies to illustrate how this may be an important difference. This was a study that was done actually of prison inmates in British Columbia. It was published in 1978 by Raskin and Hare. And as you can see in this particular mock crime study, the subjects were asked to steal $20, and then they were told they could keep the $20 if they fate or in the guilty condition, and they convinced the polygrapher that they were telling the truth. And in this particular study, the accuracy has come out very high. So guilty people were all detected. Innocent people were detected with high accuracy. Half the subjects in the study, by the way, were psychopaths, and this is one of the studies that's used to show that psychopaths can't beat the lie detector test. Now, a doctoral student of mine, when I was at the University of British Columbia, did a constructive replication of this particular study. Went to the same prison, used the same rooms, had the same facilities. We even talked to the same guards because they remembered the earlier study when it was done before. Hopefully the prisoners were different, not certain that even all the prisoners were necessarily different. But we made an important change in the study, and we were concerned that in a study like this, there wasn't any real concern about failing the polygraph. So what we did is we negotiated with the prisoners' committee of this prison such that we would give all the prisoners who participated in the study $20, but only if a certain percentage of the total group passed the test. I can't remember the exact percentage, but it was something like 60% or something like that. So we said if 60% of you pass the test, then all of you will get $20. If fewer than that pass the test, none of you get anything. And in order to make sure that we were playing straight, we then had to post to the prisoners the names of all the people who failed the test so they could be held responsible for the other prisoners not getting their $20. Now, there was a lot of evidence. I don't know if you do this study today, but we were able to do it then. And there was a lot of evidence from the kind of exchanges that we had with subjects in this study that they really were concerned. For instance, one subject in the study dropped out partway through the polygraph test and said, "I just can't go on," and we tried to find out why. And he said, "I'm worried I could get piped as a consequence of this." And we never fully understood what getting piped was, but it didn't sound like anything that we would want him to be subjected to or anybody else that we could think of. So when we redid this study following a very similar design, but enhancing the consequences of being found guilty, we got quite different results. And the results in particular are different for the innocent people, who now have something legitimately to fear as a consequence of taking a test. And now the relevant questions in this context end up being much more significant, and the overall accuracy is much lower. And this study was published in the Journal of Applied Psychology back in '89. There are problems with laboratory studies. I don't want to make it sound like they're not useful for answering any question, but I don't think they're useful for answering this particular question of how accurate these techniques are. And in particular, in laboratory studies, I think innocent people actually have good reason to be more bothered by the control or comparison questions, because these are the only questions they're confronted with that involve dishonesty. And if they fail a test, the consequences are relatively minimal. Guilty persons, likewise, have no real incentive to beat the test, and they don't really have any opportunity either to figure out how to do it. And also, laboratory studies, if they're done well, in order to get them published, are really standardized, well-controlled procedures, unlike what's done in real life. Now, field studies are also used to estimate the accuracy of polygraph tests, and it's already been mentioned that one of the standards that's followed to do this is to rely on confessions. So if you have three or four suspects in a case, let's say you've got four of them, all of them take polygraph tests, one confesses, that one is identified by confession as guilty, and the other three in the same place are cleared as innocent. After we know that outcome, we can then go back and see what the polygraph test actually showed in terms of who is guilty and who is innocent. Now, the problem with confession studies is that the only cases selected for study are those where the original examiner was correct. And I can illustrate that with this series of flowcharts. But you give literally hundreds and hundreds of polygraph tests, and they're in a data set, in a file cabinet. You go through these trying to find the ones that have confessions. Well, you're not going to find polygraph tests that worked out this way. Polygraph test was administered, was scored truthful, there's no confession. You're not going to select this case because there's no confession to verify this outcome, but this could be a false negative. Now, a guilty person who takes a polygraph test isn't going to go up to the polygrapher at the end of the session when the polygrapher says, "Well, I think you're honest, you can go," and say, well, I'm not. I'm guilty. I did it. You need somebody to do something like that in order to get a confession right here and for this case to get selected. So that case isn't going to get selected in this type of study. Now, likewise, you're going to get situations like this where a polygraph test is scored deceptive. There's no confession. You're not going to select this one because you're missing ground truth, but this could be a false positive. If an innocent person takes a polygraph test, fails it, they're not going to confess. They have no reason to confess. They leave under a cloud, but in the end, we don't have any ground truth for this particular outcome, so we're not going to select that case either. So in the end, the cases that get selected are these. A polygraph test is scored deceptive. The polygrapher in the post-test interview that interviews the person to try and get a confession, the person confesses, now we select this case for the study, and we pull along with it all the innocent co-suspects who are also tested with a polygraph and found truthful. But we ask this question, was the polygraph scored deceptive? And we go back here and we find out that the original examiner scored it deceptive. This is why when Dr. Hunt says the original examiners in these field studies have a high accuracy rate, the accuracy rate of the original examiner should be 100%. So if you get an accuracy rate of the original examiner in these types of field studies that's lower than 100%, it means they're actually not following their own conventions, and they're trying to get confessions of people that they shouldn't be trying to get confessions from. Because you can only if the original examiner scores the charge deceptive or believes the person deceptive, is that person going to go for the confession. And only if they get the confession are you going to go back and look at the charge to see what information it contains.
I mean, there's one flaw in this analysis, and that assumes that the police do no additional investigation.
Well, I'll get to that.
Because in the field studies that I've worked on, about half of the cases fit the green box, about done. And the ones that don't were resolved because the police continued to investigate and found stolen property in a person's house, or they got a confession that was unrelated to a polygraph test. So this only holds if you ignore the fact that the police might be doing other investigative work.
Well,
can
I
just
get you
said, you know, sometimes maybe there's four suspects, and surely it's possible that two out of the four could be scored deceptive?
Yeah, well, this relates to police practices and how polygraph is actually used in real life. I can tell you that I've worked with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Canada, which follow practices very similar to those in the United States. And as a consequence of other types of research I've tried to do, we work with other police departments, like the Los Angeles Police Department, the Ocala Sheriff's Department, and the Minneapolis Police Department, etc. And basically, police agencies use polygraph as a tool of last resort to help resolve a case. Now, I'm not saying they use it this way in every single case. There are other times when they use polygraph as well. But oftentimes, what you have is a case where the evidence is kind of ambiguous, and the investigators get the idea, well, I bet if we use the polygraph, we could rattle somebody here to confess, and we'd resolve this case. So typically, by the time a case gets to the point of going before polygraph operators, for the vast majority of them, the case has already been investigated, the evidence is exhausted, and there isn't any real opportunity to resolve the case any other way. So the polygraph is used to resolve the case with the hope that if a person fails, they'll confess. Now, I can tell you, because I've done a study where we've systematically followed up over 400 cases like this by the police, that these same detectives who refer a case for polygraph, if the case comes back guilty, they stop their investigation. Because they've already done it. And now the polygrapher says, this is the person who's guilty. Their view at that point is that, well, we know who did it, we're not going to bring him to trial, there's no point investigating the case further. If that case comes back innocent, then they say, or truthful, then they say, well, we've been focusing on the wrong person, I'm going to keep the case open, and they're going to continue the investigation. And most police agencies will tell you that they want to use the polygraph this way, that is, at the point of almost last resort, because they don't want their investigators to become overly dependent on a polygraph. And they see the polygraph as a precious resource that needs to be used sparingly. So they're not going to use it indiscriminately. They're going to use it in these kinds of cases. And our study that we published in 1991 by the RCMP actually makes this point. I'll get to that in a second.
I think so this is... Let me try and say what I think you just said. I said, what if there were multiple people, and you're saying typically there weren't multiple people?
Okay, now I'm sorry, I didn't quite fully answer your question. It's completely different if you have multiple people and there may be like a conspiracy or several people who are involved.
Who may pull the trigger.
If it's a bank heist, let's say, someone had to drive the getaway car, someone had to rob the bank. There's two people involved, there's four suspects. You can get, obviously, different types of outcomes. But if it's a crime that you're pretty sure only one person committed, then it's handled like there's going to be one guilty person. If there's four suspects and the first person tested comes out guilty, in the police jurisdictions that I've looked at and gone through their records, they typically wouldn't investigate the other three with polygraph.
Okay, so it's very unusual that you would kind of ask four people.
It would be very unusual, and if you think about it, it makes sense, because if you believe the techniques works, and there's only one person who could be guilty, and the first one tested is guilty, then you've pretty much forced the outcome for the other three, and why bother to do it, especially if people have other people to test and other crimes to help resolve. I think one of the most important points I can make today, and this relates to, I think, Dr. Hunt's opening comment about the power of the technique. The power of the technique is explained by this flowchart that I just showed you. And it has to do with the fact, why do examiners believe the polygraph works? They're not scientists. When they come across evidence that disagrees with their verdict, they tend to dismiss the evidence. For instance, if a trial court says, the person's not guilty and the polygraph says the person's guilty, it's because trial courts don't allow all the evidence to go before the jury. Like they didn't allow the polygraph evidence to go before the jury, for instance. Also, I think, 99% of the polygraphers are moral, ethical people. And I don't think you can do a test like this that has profound effects on the lives of people without believing that it's almost infallible. Otherwise, how do you sleep at night? Knowing that you're giving a test that leads people to losing their jobs, not getting jobs, being prosecuted for crimes, and this sort of thing. But the most important part of this is that polygraphers don't have the opportunity to learn of their mistakes, and they receive feedback selectively, but when they're correct. And that's because of the way this procedure works. When someone is deemed to fail the test, you try and get a confession from them. And oftentimes people confess. When you see that, you've got reinforcement that you're right. But you're missing all these other people in the flowchart. The field polygrapher has no information. They score someone deceptive, tries to get a confession, and they don't confess. No information there, no information here. The information comes here. And so they are selectively reinforced and learn of time they're right, but they don't get much opportunity at all to learn when they're wrong. I testified in court once, and a polygrapher who ran a polygraph agency said that he had been involved in 137,000 polygraph tests, and not one was shown to be an error. Now, how do you make a statement like that? You make a statement like that because of a flowchart like the one I just showed you. It has to do with the fact that for the vast majority of cases, you don't have an opportunity to detect an error, and you set your threshold for what constitutes an error pretty high. So it's easy to make a statement like under oath in court and not feel like you're lying. And I think that's why we're here today, is because of the power of the technique, because the fact that the people who use this technique see that people will confess. They'll admit things like taking unauthorized information home. They'll admit having a discussion with their spouse about classified information. They will bare their soul about murders, about sex crimes, and about these sorts of things after they fail polygraph tests. Polygraphers are great interrogators, the good ones. And this is incredibly reinforcing. And that's why people who apply these techniques believe they work. They're just human. They're not unlike psychotherapists and people who do other kinds who practice other types of trades. They go by what they see, and what they don't see, they don't worry about. So, if you use confessions as ground truth, you end up overestimating polygraph accuracy. The cases that involve original examiner error excluded, the cases that are selected are those where the original examiner was correct, and you need an independent estimate of ground truth. And this is what we did in our study with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And there's two ways to look at the results of this study. Again, we started out with over 400 cases with multiple suspects. These were all the cases that were in their registry of cases that they went through. So it wasn't a selected sample. And then we identified all the cases where there were confessions. And out of these 400 cases, there were 20 people who were deemed innocent by the confession of someone else, and 49 people who were found guilty. And you can see when we went back then and had the RCMP score their own charts, truthful people only were detected with about 55% accuracy, and guilty people were tested with 98% accuracy. Now, in particular, for guilty people, the number should be 100%, because in order to get this result, one of these 49 people actually passed the test. But the polygrapher played a hunch, went after that person, and got a confession. And when we went back and looked at the physiological charts and had independent evaluators, the term Dr. Hunt used, look at that chart, they said, this chart indicates this person's telling the truth. But the polygrapher got a confession out of that person anyway. Now, what we did with these 400 cases, for all of them, is they were all referred to the RCMP polygraph division from what are called detachments, which are like precincts in this country. And we went through the case files of all of these things, trying to find additional evidence that would indicate who was guilty and who wasn't. And what we found was that there was additional evidence for this for innocent people, but there was no real additional evidence for guilty people. And this relates to the point I just made a moment ago, which is that if a person takes a polygraph test and fails, when you go to the police files in the local precinct to look at the last piece of paper that's in the file, the last piece of paper that's in the file says, Joe failed the polygraph test. But if a person is judged innocent, then they continue to investigate, and then we're able to find corroborating evidence in the form of confessions that we could then use to determine how well the test worked with innocent people. So for these innocent people, again, the rate of detection was low in the sense that there was only a 56% accuracy rate. We couldn't calculate the accuracy rate for guilty people because we only found one person out of 402 cases where the investigation continued at this point. So I think that this problem of how confessions are used to identify cases where the confession follows a polygraph test produces a very biased set of cases and almost guarantees that the studies that are done this way are going to show high accuracy in terms of how the test works. And that's one of the reasons why I think meta-analyses and literature reviews are problematic. I'll just go through this quickly. I'm almost done. First place, this is a field where there's a great dearth of quality research. This profession has been around for 80 years, and social scientists have ignored it. There are very few people who have gotten interested in working on it, and a lot of the research that's been done is in the form of technical reports and reports done by practitioners who aren't scientists. meta-analyses that look at polygraph literature, I think, are problematic if they're going to rely on this huge body of unpublished literature and studies that are published in polygraph trade journals. And meta-analysis, you worry about the file drawer problem, which is the idea that people are studying a phenomenon, they get non-significant results, and they don't bother to publish it. In this field, most of the studies that aren't published get highly positive results. Some of the studies report accuracies like 99%, even 100%, that are cited by polygraph operators, for instance, proponents of the polygraph, when they're talking to clients about how accurate their techniques are. We should immediately be skeptical of studies that claim accuracy rates that high, and they're not likely to get published. If you just consider the test studies, the test for espionage and sabotage that were published by the government, these studies of the test got pretty high accuracy rates, but in the design of these studies, at the conclusion of the polygraph test, the guilty people were told to confess. If the polygrapher said, you failed the test, you did it, didn't you? The guilty person would say, yeah, I did it. The innocent person, though, if he was told he failed the test, was given an opportunity to talk his way out of it.
And if the innocent person had a plausible explanation for why he might have responded to the relevant questions, then the innocent person was scored as a truthful outcome on a test. Well, I mean, this is an obvious lack of parallel across these two conditions. In real life, if you're a spy and you're deemed guilty on the polygraph test, you're going to use your psychopathic qualities and whatever other qualities you might have to try and talk your way out of it, just like an innocent person with a false positive outcome would do. So if we really want to know how this test worked in that study, then we would have liked to have everyone who failed the test try and convince the polygrapher that there's a reason why they responded to those relevant questions. They liked novels about spies, and they were reading an especially juicy one the night before, and they really came to identify with the main character who had the same name they did, or something like that, and that allowed them to get through. Also, when field studies are used to estimate polygraph accuracy, no one pays attention to this confession bias problem, so all the studies are just lumped together as though there's nothing in particular wrong with using confessions to select these cases, even though they really then produce overstated accuracy rates. And then the issue for me is not whether or not the test works or not how large the effect size is, but whether the test work at the rates that they need to work in order to be used for things like intelligence screening. We can't be happy with polygraph tests that have 80% accuracy. Like the urban meta-analysis, which includes all these confession studies in there, for instance, you know, it says, well, polygraph's 80% accurate. If the polygraph is 80% accurate, do we want to screen thousands and thousands of government employees where 1/100th of 1% might be a spy with a test like that and then deal with the consequences? I don't think the government wants to do that, and they don't do it because they don't allow the numbers to fail that should fail if they actually follow the procedures to the letter as they're supported by their own research.
Are there any methods, or could you envision any methods that therefore would be justifiable for screening for camera intelligence purposes?
Well, there may be some alternative technique, but I don't know. I don't know enough about where we could go from here. Maybe Dr. Donchin will talk a little bit about this. But for instance, a former student of his, Farwell, and an FBI agent named Drew Richardson, and I think some other people in the FBI, did a study where they took FBI recruits and had them look at a computer screen, and words were flashed on the computer screen that only FBI personnel would likely know the meaning of. And they averaged their brain evoked potential to these words and other words and could show that the FBI recruits recognized these kinds of words. I think you could use a procedure like this to detect spies if you had reason to believe that spies have certain kinds of information that they're not supposed to have.